My talk sort of consists of three parts. I'll first give you an introduction to quantum information theory. You know, of course, most of you will certainly have seen some introduction to quantum information theory, even if you're not working in the field. But maybe it should also serve the purpose to sort of introduce my view of the field to you. And then I will talk about Pauli's principle and some generalizations of it. And in the third part of my talk, I'll connect it to entanglement, and we'll see how these extensions of Pauli's principle relate to that. So let me give you a bit of an introduction, and sort of my view of the world. Information theory started in 1948 with Claude Shannon, who made sort of one key step. He managed to abstract the concept of information independent of physical implementation. So here, the information is represented by a bit string, and it can represent information both in a punch hole card and magnetic memory and a CD drive. And this abstraction, this concept of abstraction, really, together with the idea that all physical information can be represented in that way, led to what is information theory. And around the same time, Alan Turing made a similar achievement in the realm of computation. So he abstracted computation from its physical implementation. And there we have the theoretical concept of a Turing machine, which is, of course, modeled somehow by a tape recorder type machine, which represents, at least theoretically, the old SUSE and IBM or an iPad or a BlackBerry. And all physical, the Church-Turing thesis says that all physical computation can be represented in that way, and that is the basis for modern computer science, modern complexity theory, and so on. It is somewhat surprising that Shannon and Turing's notions are actually based on classical physics, and especially the property that information always has a definite value. Even though already a few decades earlier, people realized that classical physics isn't the final answer, and that atoms are actually not governed by classical physics. So from this, we see already that Shannon and Turing's notions, they do not directly apply to atoms and molecules and quantum information. So of course, in quantum mechanics, the state of a system is given by a wave function. And measurement values of this wave functions, they do not exist prior to measurement, even in principle. So even in principle, even in principle, Shannon and Turing's notions do not apply to quantum mechanics. And I think this is sort of gives us a fundamental reason that we need an information theory and a theory of computation that applies to quantum mechanics. And of course, as a bonus, we may have some new technological applications. But let me just give you a very brief, of course, we have the 0 and the 1 that now turn into vectors, the 1-0 vector and the 0-1 vector. And the superposition principle tells us that our state of a qubit can be in superposition. So, state of a qubit is just a vector alpha beta, which because of the normalization, you can think of as a point on a sphere, giving us more possibilities than for bit, which is just a point north pole or south pole. And of course, the way to produce strings of bits, that's just the tensor product rule. And entanglement is then formed by combining the tensor product rule with the superposition principle that gives rise to entangled quantum states, which we can produce in different experiments, in optical experiments, in ion traps, in optical lattices, in superconducting qubits, in many different physical systems. We can do this nowadays in a controlled way. And there, the idea now is, of course, that quantum physical information can be represented in that way and can be broken down into qubits. And that is the basis for quantum information theory, which then gives rise to these new possibilities for technological applications in addition. So we have both a fundamental reason to study it, but also a technological application side comes sort of as a bonus. So my research in this...
Yep.
That's right. Quantum theory is much richer. Well, in some sense, I would say you can include it into quantum information theory.
But then you have to go beyond the discrete examples.
Yes, you would have to. I mean, you have to. I mean, you could either say I can truncate my spaces and sort of break it down into qubits effectively by putting like energy cutoffs. And that would be one way of treating it. But of course, if you want to study, say, relativistic, then you may have to understand space-time at the same time. It's not a way of viewing it. My research, however, is much confined to, say, the non-relativistic effects, non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And in particular, what interests me in this, in quantum information theory, in quantum physics, is the relation of the whole and the parts of a quantum state. So I want to understand how they're related, how is parts of a quantum state related to the whole, and there are different aspects, different ways you can ask these questions. You can ask them as, how can I understand reduced density matrices? How are they related? How are they interrelated with the whole? You can ask questions that this sort of study has applications, maybe surprisingly, in complexity theory. But then also some of the motivations come from condensed matter physics, from quantum chemistry. That is actually an aspect I'll mention later. A second area is, of course, entanglement, these sort of quantum correlations that are stronger than classical correlations. And this is an area that then has applications in quantum cryptography, but of course it's also related to foundations of physics. And my research maybe surprisingly also reveals some connection to classical computer science, to algebraic complexity theory, through the relation of tensors and entanglement. And tensors are also playing a role in that thing. So that's maybe a mathematical connection to classical computer science. And the last one, focus of my research is into entropy and into relations of different entropies. And that is then motivated in part by quantum coding theory. It sort of has its certainly the some foundation in mathematical physics and maybe novel applications in the area of optimization. So I talked about some result actually 2 days ago at the University of Waterloo on a paper joint with Fernando Brandao and John Yard, which plays in the entropy realm. Today I'd like to show you a result about density matrices, and particularly in the fermionic case in the quantum chemistry realm. And then I will tell you about how this is related to entanglement, and that is a second piece of work that will then come at the end of my talk. So let's move to this to fermions. So I have here an atom with a few electrons around it. And let's start with Pauli's principle. So let's get some notation clear. What is Pauli's principle? So with the Pauli's exclusion principle, I mean that two fermionic particles two fermions can be in the same quantum state. And this you can sort of say, if you measure the occupation numbers of some quantum system, then the occupation probabilities, then they are between 0 and 1. Is it number of fermions that occupy it? They can be 0, can be 1, but it could also be something in between, depending on your physical system. And it's remarkably powerful because it already explains a good deal, together with just understanding the hydrogen atom. It explains already a good deal of the structure of atoms and of the buildup of the table of elements. So, for instance, here on each level you have two quantum states, namely spin up or down, and you can fill the electrons in, and you see that you already kind of learn something. If you know the energy structure, you learn how to fill them in just with Pauli's principle, because there cannot be more than one electron on each energy level. Then, of course, Pauli's principle is also powerful. It sort of explains to us, can argue that white dwarfs don't collapse into arbitrarily small matter. Actually, this here is the white dwarf, Pauli's principle was strengthened and was derived in some sense by Dirac and Heisenberg in 26, who stated that quantum states of fermions are antisymmetric, so that that when you exchange two particles, you get this minus sign. And you can easily see that this actually implies the Pauli exclusion principle from above. I'd like to, for this talk, still stick to the notation that this I call Pauli's exclusion principle, and that here I call the antisymmetry of the wave function. So that I don't refer to, some people refer to this as being Pauli's exclusion principle, but I would like not like to do this for this talk. So let's set this up mathematically. What are occupation numbers? So I drew you a Hilbert space here, or maybe a set of pure quantum states. We consider fixed particle numbers, say 3. Think of an atom, beryllium has 4. I don't know. Yeah, think of a small number, of small number n. Then we have the Hilbert space, and we have the antisymmetric tensor product of this. And I think of a wave function just as an element in that antisymmetric space. So what is the one particle reduced density matrix? Well, if you look here at the right-hand side, it is just the expectation value of AI dagger AJ, where these are the creation and annihilation operators for a fermion in mode I and mode J. And that gives you a matrix. I mean, for simplicity, I just truncated here at 3, but you may think of like a matrix that is as big as the dimension of your Hilbert space, which we also think of being finite for the moment. That's going to be fine for us. So the occupation numbers then are just the expectation values of AI dagger AI. So these are the diagonal elements of this matrix. And we know by Pauli's principle that they are between 0 and 1, where we use this normalization that the total sum of them sums to n. So you can again think of n as being 3 or 4 or something like this. So in some sense, what we get is a map from the set of pure quantum states to, I drew here sort of a square, to the set of occupation numbers. I mean, if you think of this here being N1 and N2, and then N3 is in sort of the third direction. So basically, it's this sort of simple object, this hypercube cut out by this equality constraint. And you can ask yourself, can you, you know, do you reach all of it? And yes, you can show that by, you know, all sets of occupation numbers that satisfy these two constraints, you can reach by with some wave function that is not very difficult to see. Well, what are natural occupation numbers? So occupation numbers were these diagonal elements, and arguably they were depends on the basis choice. What are the occupation numbers? So for an experimentalist, it depends on your experimental setting. What are the occupation numbers in your system? And most experimentalists actually have only one setting available. So for them, it's sort of clear what it is. But some experimentalists have more control over the system and can measure different types of occupation numbers. So I call natural occupation numbers the ones where this one particle reduced density matrix is diagonal. So you may just look in the basis in which this matrix is diagonal and call these eigen occupation numbers or natural occupation numbers. And they are, of course, occupation numbers. And so they map into this region. But the question is, are there additional, you may ask yourself, are there additional constraints on these occupation numbers than just the ones given by Pauli's principle? And, you know, maybe there are no constraints. Maybe they're weird. But it turns out they're linear. And if you think about it for a moment, it's very surprising that the constraints on this should be linear, because there's no apparent convexity in the problem, because you have a pure wave function, just a wave function for the overall system. So let's do an example. That example is from 1972. By Dennis and Borland, two quantum chemists, I believe. And they looked at 3 fermions in 6 modes, so a 6-dimensional space. And here's what they figured out. So the eigenvalues, we're going to order them non-increasingly. So lambda 1 is bigger than lambda 2, you know, without loss of generality. And I'm just going to order them. Then they noticed that if you add the first and the last one, they sum up to 1. The second and the fifth sum up to 1, and the third and the fourth sum up to 1. You can sort of think it's some particle hole duality, but it isn't really, because as soon as you would consider 7 dimensions, this would go away. But anyway, the interesting one, though, I think, is this one, is lambda 1 plus lambda 2 plus lambda 4 is smaller than 2. So we know by Pauli's principle that the first two are smaller than 2, but even if you add the fourth one in, it's smaller than 2. So that is clearly
interacting fermions.
Sorry?
These 3 fermions, do they interact?
Oh, for the moment, this is just a statement about the structure of any fermionic wave function. So for any fermionic wave function, regardless of which system this is the ground state of, it will have this property. The one particle reduced density matrix eigenvalues will satisfy these constraints. and if and only if. So for every set of numbers, they will exist this a wave function such that has this these occupation numbers. So you can draw it. It's a convex polytope. Oh, you see, you have six variables, right? Three constraints. So there are three variables left. So I may just look at this as a set in three-dimensional space. And I put them here, lambda 1, 2, 3. And then you see this is the inequality on that side. And in order to get some intuition, maybe a Slater determinant would be the occupation numbers 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0. Right? Because you have three, you have occupied with 1, and then the other three are empty. So it maps to that point. I can rotate that for you, actually, if you like. Sort of my gadget allows it, and I even brought it. Look at this. It got a bit damaged on the You see, it's kind of a bit complicated because these the first three of these. You know, there's only one inequality here, and the others are just the constraints that one has to be bigger than the other. So you can see it here if you look at it. There's one that says lambda 4 is equal to lambda 5 plus lambda 6. So you can sort of take a, you know, if you want to get it around. You can also play around with them yourself if you like. We have a website, and you can rotate them for yourself and try to understand. We have some more examples of this type. Well, okay, so this is actually a general fact. So in general, regardless of which number of fermions, which number of modes, you'll get a convex polytope, even if you, say, have a different type of symmetry. So I did this for fermions, but even if you have spins or other symmetries, it will. If you can generalize this, it will have this fact. So some time ago, I gave some representation theoretic inner characterization of this in collaboration with Graham Richardson, not in the fermionic case, but in the distinguishable particle case, which directly generalizes to this fermionic case, and an outer characterization, namely a direct computation of these inequalities, was sort of given by Kliuchko in 2004 and 2006, and Daftua Hayden also had a paper in four. They were all in the same week, so that was kind of funny coincidence.
Is there some sort of limit in which the size of the number of modes goes to infinity?
I don't actually know much about this limit, actually. So if your number of particles is fixed and number of modes goes to infinity, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. We're looking at this, but we don't really know. It just seems to get more complicated for the moment, and I have not. But certainly, it's a very interesting question.
Are they only constraints? So all those are realizable?
Yes.
When they satisfy.
Yes.
Did you say something like this is not necessary for fermions, but you could have anions or bosons?
Anions, I don't know. But for bosons and for also for distinguishable particles where you ask for the set of eigenvalues of the reduced density matrices, this is also true.
So what is it true, that you end up with a polytope?
Yes, the set of eigenvalues end up with a polytope, yeah, convex polytope.
Sorry, if you take simple Slater determinants,
is
6 modes, do you lie on the boundary of this polytope? Suppose it's Slater determinant.
Every Slater determinant maps to this point.
I see.
So just to that point.
Every Slater, okay.
Every Slater determinant maps to that point because I'm just looking at the eigenvalues. So every Slater determinant will map to this point. So as soon as you have some correlated fermion system, if you like to think that way, you will be somewhere inside this polytope, but not on this point. So physical relevance. Why is this physically relevant? Is there physical relevance to these new constraints? That is sort of the question we asked ourselves. Pauli's principle. What is then sort of you have to trace back a moment, right? You have to think what is the physical relevance of Pauli's principle, and somehow it's the relevance that it prevents electrons from falling down. So if you think about this thing here, what does the Pauli principle say without referring to the fermionic nature to the antisymmetry? It's just it prevents this electron from falling to this one because there's already one sitting on each of the two levels. So it means that the constraints are active in the sense that these occupation numbers here are either one or zero. Then you're sort of, something is prevented from falling. And we call them, the occupation numbers are pinned, and you may think, it, you know, it's, they sit up there, right? So at some point. So is there a physical system where these new constraints are active in the sense that, like, there's a boundary and it hits it, and it sort of, it prevents it from doing something? And actually, Kliuchko, again, he suggested that maybe beryllium, maybe beryllium, some state of beryllium, he pulled out some numerics out of some paper that suggested that might be the case. So we kind of tried to look at this, but then I asked my colleague, and it's poisonous. So you should really stay away from beryllium, which is here, has four electrons, and it also gets more complicated. We wanted to get some more mathematically rigorous insight into this. So we studied harmonium, or what you may call harmonium. It is three fermions just connected by springs in a ball. So that's what we wanted to study. We studied this. We it was our first system we looked at. So we studied with this infinite dimensional system. And then we had to do some truncation analysis. So we truncated to six levels. Controlling the truncation, I just gave you, for a specific value of the interaction strength, you just put you some numbers up here. And you sort of look at the numbers, and I don't know if you see the structure. So we wanted to ask ourselves, is this saturated? So we start lambda 1, we add lambda 2, we add lambda 4, and yes, it's saturated. It's equal to 2. There's an easier way of, it sort of sticks to the boundary. It's an easier way of seeing it because this is equivalent to this inequality here by using these equality constraints. Mm-hmm. And then you can see that that these two here, they sum exactly to this last, to the third one. And so you may think the physical significance now is that the upper two occupation, it can't fall down to that level because the occupation below has to be higher. That's sort of one way of, you may think about this. So we did this for arbitrary delta, and then you see that it moves the line, and it's drawn in the polytope. If you have it in your hands right now, you can see a line going from the slated determinant down here with order delta to 4, and the approximation error is delta to the 8. To that six level. So that is really sticking to the boundary, and we're very pleased this sort of highlighted by the editor and PRL. So what do we learn? One question to ask, maybe.
So
what do I learn?
Delta is the interaction strength.
Sorry?
What is delta? Is that the interaction strength?
Yes, the interaction strength, yes. So you see, as if it's uncorrelated, you have a slated determinant, as you would expect. Mm-hmm. And then you switch on the interaction, and it starts moving. But, you know, in general, it may move somewhere inside this polytope, right? But it sort of sticks to the boundary, suggesting that there's something kind of pushing against it from the other side.
But didn't you say also that you could cover all the polytope?
Yes, you can cover all the polytope,
so
yes.
This is a statement about your particular interaction.
That's right. It's a statement about particular interaction. So we wanted to see if there is a physical system whose behavior is sort of governed by this. I mean, certainly not all physical systems will show such behavior.
Did you say this was the ground state?
That's the ground state, yeah. So what do we learn for... you may ask now, what do I learn from this for the wave function? Can I maybe derive some information for the wave function? And so we look at the system... in detail, so the whole thing is 20-dimensional. And just as a reminder, I drew this up there. So a general state, you know, we kind of have to mod out by the unitary rotations because we are only interested in the eigenvalue. So if you mod out by them, you can write a general state in terms of 8 components instead of 20. That turns out to be the case for the system. And it turns out that the states on the boundary, they just have 3 components. So, and these particular 3 components, so they're ordered in this way. And so here is what you may think you could do. So at least some sort of some idea, right? So assume someone tells you that your system is almost uncorrelated. Then what you would do if you wanted to solve and compute the ground state energy, you would say, okay, fine, I do Hartree-Fock. That means I'm optimized over all slated determinants. And now you you know, but some oracle told you your system was, you know, just weakly correlated. And now we may have the same, right? So if some oracle tells you that your system is almost on the boundary, it's just some other statement that an oracle would tell you, then what you could do is you could optimize over the states on the boundary, and somehow the result would be 4 orders of magnitude better than Hartree-Fock. You know, I don't want to suggest we have this sort of, you know, improvement over Hartree-Fock. This is just sort of one example. But I think it may be useful to think about insights we get from this polytope, and we haven't explored this at all, this idea to use this sort of in practice. But you see that it sort of improves over some naive way. And I mean, chemists actually do this. They have some, when they improve Hartree-Fock, they take additional slated determinants into account, and then they take some more. And I think what we may suggest is that to take very particular ones, namely the ones that maybe are on the boundary. So that's some idea in this direction. We're exploring this a little bit further right now.
So yes? Is the statement that this wave function is the sum of three wave determinants?
Yes.
So in this technique where they take a linear combination of slated determinants, they also optimize over slated determinants. So they would find this thing.
Yes. Yes, that's right. If they also optimize over three, they would find this. That's right. That's right. But somehow we, for this, you sort of have a very particular structure here. It's 1, 2, 3. You know, if you choose a basis, this is like 1, 2, 3 and 1, 4, 5 and 2, 4, 6. Just so, you know, there is some more structure in it for these states on the boundary.
But that we already mapped out all the unitary transformations.
Yes.
So probably that would be the optimization
there,
finding these unitary transformations.
Yes.
See, also, quantum chemists will do what you call as configuration, which
yes.
is guided based on quantum number conservation.
Yes.
So that will already put you in this particular specific linear combination.
Yes, but we don't know. I mean, a priori, you would just know that the wave function has this structure on that boundary you would optimize over. So, I don't want to sort of claim too much here. I was just going to suggest that we gain some insight about the structure.
I mean, it's clear that
yeah.
you do. But so again, this you don't have a guarantee that the ground state is going to be on the surface. It's just an observation.
No, no, but it's the same with Hartree-Fock, right? I have no guarantee that my system is uncorrelated. Yeah.
And can you tell me how the number of phases or the number of components that you have on the boundary scales with the system size?
We don't know. But it goes up drastically.
So
Yeah, okay. It's also hard to compute. But it's possible. But it's sort of a way of thinking about these states. You can make statements as soon as you know you're in the boundary. So if you have some physical insight, it will tell you, then you could maybe use this in order to get some information about the structure. And what sort of this suggests, I mean, we're making the connection now to my second topic, what this somehow suggests that there is some, you know, you may say, well, these are entangled of a certain type. But it somehow suggests that there is some relation between entanglement and the geometry of these polytopes. Somehow there seems to be some relation between the structure of the wave function of this type and the geometry, and I'm going to keep it that way vague for the moment. I would like to now come to this entanglement part, where we study the relation between the polytope and maybe surprising relation to the study of entanglement. So what is entanglement? Well, typically you have like Alice, Bob, and Charlie, and you know, and you can say fancy sentences like entanglement. These are unique quantum mechanical correlations. But then there is some technical. We have to at some point come to a technical definition, and the technical definition is that psi and phi have the same type of entanglement if they can be interconverted with local operations and classical communications. And I think you know, Giffre sort of noticed that local operations and classical communication are terribly difficult. Class of operations, so they introduce this stochastic here, which makes it a little bit easier to treat. So it sort of gives you an algebraic characterization of two wave functions and when they're in the same type of entanglement. And in the case of fermions, the right way of formulating this is to say that psi and phi are related by invertible linear transformations of the modes. So in general, if Alice and Bob and Charlie had like distinguishable particles, then each of them would have a different linear operation that it can transform on. And I emphasize linear, invertible linear, rather than unitary. So you can do really more with this. And I wiped the normalization under the carpet. So that's our notion of entanglement. Two things are related. If they're in the same orbit, you can also say under the general linear group of transformations on the modes. So again, let's look at three fermions and six modes, just to stay with our example. There are four types of entanglement. People studied this already some years back. I think in the current formulation, there's Peter Levi and Peter Vrana made this classification very explicit. There are four representative states. One is, if I start from below, is the Slater determinant. That's just sort of the uncorrelated, unentangled state, if you want. Then you have the next one here is sort of just two of the particles are correlated, and then the next one is in a Slater determinant type state. So this is what we call biseparable state. The next one is the sort of W type entanglement for the expert, and the other one is a GHZ type entanglement. But good, anyway, these are the states. More fermions, more modes. This gets really an infinite number of types. I mean, you can see the reason the dimension of your space grows exponentially, but the number of the transformation kind of stays the same.
So when you say four types, in what sense they are different types?
Oh, in the sense that I'm looking at the orbits under the general linear group. And in this particular case, there are four orbits of this stochastic LOCC operations, we'd call them. Yeah. So the four orbits under this entanglement transformations. But you see, for more fermions, more modes, I get many parameters, exponentially many. I have an infinite number of types, and they are not locally accessible. Somehow, if I want to understand them, I have to look at the whole wave function. So that's sort of difficult in experiments. And in general, I think people sort of think this is largely intractable, and more than sporadic examples have really not been calculated.
When you say infinite number, does it mean there's a continuous parameter in the orbit?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So the 3 and 6 are just a special
case. Yeah, it's a special case. Yeah, it's only finite in this special finite case. Yeah, even for 4 and 8 or something, it's already parameters. But coming back to our natural occupation numbers, we ask ourselves what happens to the set that I map into if I start with an entanglement class. Right? So instead of the whole Hilbert space, I just take one orbit. And where does it map to? And in particular, you can ask the question, are there additional constraints on these occupation numbers? And you can go through the same, right? Maybe there are no constraints. Maybe there are weird constraints right now inside this other polytope. And surprise, it turns out there are linear constraints. Again, you have linear constraints here, and these we'd like to call entanglement polytopes. So every entanglement class maps to an entanglement polytope. And let's go to our example, to sort of get a bit of hands-on things. So what you see, what turns out, I mean, let's start again from the right. The Slater determinant, Slater determinant under general linear transformations will stay Slater determinant. So that just stays your point, that's a polytope, that's okay. This biseparable state, you will be able to change the amplitude of these two here. That actually produces you a line segment. And the if you start with this psi b here, the W type entanglement, it will give you the upper pyramid. So if you have this polytope somewhere, then you see that it consists of two parts, really. It's a whole thing, but you may cut it here in the middle, and the upper pyramid, only these here map into the upper pyramid, and this one here maps into the whole pyramid. And the reason for this is actually that this state, this here, is actually dense in the set of all states. So therefore, this actually maps into the whole polytope. But you already see that now you can distinguish, you could distinguish different types of entanglement. If you, for instance, measured occupation numbers that were sort of in the lower pyramid here, then you would immediately exclude this one, and this type of entanglement, and you would have witnessed entanglement of the former type. And that is sort of a general theorem that the occupation numbers of all states of a given entanglement class, they form a convex polytope. And it's joint work with my PhD student, Michael Walter, Brent Duran, an algebraic geometer, and David Kroos. And there is some related work by Savitsky, Osmaniec, and Kush. And what we use to prove this is sort of group representation theory. In particular, if you're a bit familiar with algebraic geometry, there's something called Brillouin's theorem that that allows you to prove that it's a convex polytope. And I actually mentioned this just before, so entanglement witness, maybe just visually once more. So if you measure the occupation numbers here, then you know you're not in that entanglement class. This way you exclude entanglement classes, and you can sort of say it's in these remaining ones or how it is. So it's, I believe, the first systematic, or it's a systematic statement about entanglement. It's finite. There's only a finite number of polytopes. And then the information is single particle accessible, although I should qualify, you have to have the witness that the whole thing is pure state. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So you have to kind of know, but this is a two-particle accessible thing, so it should be okay. And it gives you some hierarchy, because you see that these polytopes are sort of inside each other. It gives you a hierarchy of entanglement, and it also works for bosons, qubits, and so on. So let me finally come to three qubits, just maybe good to see a different example than the fermions. So for three qubit states, there's a wave function of three qubits. There are three one-particle reduced density matrices. Now they can be different. Right before, the antisymmetry or the symmetry made them identical. Now there are three different ones. And of course, they're 2x2 matrices, so I can diagonalize them to see the eigenvalues. And of course, the second eigenvalue is just 1 minus the first eigenvalue. I normalize them to 1. So for each of them, I have one parameter, the largest eigenvalue. I call them lambda A, lambda B, lambda C. And that, in this particular case, would give me this polytope. It's actually sort of, if you put some symmetry on it, you get the other polytope back. This one you see here has also two pyramids that are on top of each other. And you see in this particular case that this completely uncorrelated state, the 0, 0, 0 state here, would, like our stated determinant before, maps to this case, this state. The GHZ state, this Greenberger-Horn-Zeilinger state, maps to that origin. I shifted the origin, right? So the eigenvalues of this one here are 1, 1, 1. And for this one, they are a half, a half, a half, the maximum eigenvalue. For this maximally entangled state, tensor 0, it will go to one of the points here. And if you put the 0 to a different place, you'll get the point here and the point here. And so the GHZ type gives you the whole polytope. The W type entanglement, I didn't write down what W type entanglement is, but it gives you the upper pyramid. And then again, this state will just have this polytope, and the others will be just line segments going down there. So we also sort of ventured in the adventure of going for four qubits. And you have Frank Verstraete, I think it was his PhD or so, had found out that there's 9 infinite families of entanglement classes. So there's 9 parameters, 9 families parameterized. And we figured out that there are 17 polytopes up to permutation. And 9 of them are full-dimensional, so in some sense genuinely entangled. And here's some three-dimensional cuts through them. Anyway, if you can go to our website, you can sort of play around with these 4-qubit example too. Well, with that sort of, let me conclude my talk and maybe just show you a picture of my group and the people I did this with. So this is Christian Schilling, who was involved in the first part, and then Michael Walter next to him, who was involved in the second part. And like, thank you for your attention.
So when you find that there are different types of entanglement, according to this ability to turn from one statement to another by local operations, did you find that there is only one class of events? In the sense that if you go to your system, three qubits, and you pick up a random of pure state,
yes,
it's going to be with probably one GHZ type.
That's right.
So did you find the same for fermions?
Did you find the same?
The same in the case where you had six modes and three particles.
Oh, for three particles and six modes in the fermionic case, yeah, that's the same. And the reason is somehow that three fermions and six modes you can map to three qubits. So in this particular case, the two are related. But of course, if you go for higher numbers, there is no dense orbit anymore.
There is no dense orbit.
Because by parameter counting.
And that's what you mentioned, that this classification is not so useful for Lagrange systems, right? Because you obtain, you take two states randomly. You pick up two states.
Yes.
And there is no way to connect them with local operations. That's what it means to have.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. So suppose you take your first example, and then you find some ground state, which is entangled.
Yes.
Then you tune the, or add some perturbation or some parameter.
Yes.
I mean, I'm trying to understand your entanglement orbit. Suppose there is a level crossing.
Yeah.
Will you say that you go from one orbit to another orbit? What is the?
To be honest, I have no idea. So I mean, this is just one example we studied. It was our first example. We actually first for a long time tried to reproduce these numerics, and quantum chemistry calculations turned out to be rather difficult. So we resorted to some exactly solvable model.
No, I was trying to understand.
But I don't know actually. I don't know.
Notion of entanglement orbit.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I didn't. You see, I didn't really connect the notion of. I couldn't connect the notion of entanglement to the surface. So, you see, the two parts of the talk. On the one part, I showed you that they stick to the boundary and stuff on the boundary has a certain structure. Mm-hmm. But it's not so that this certain structure just on the boundary forms an entanglement class. You know, the entanglement classes map into the. So I sort of don't make the claim that there is a close connection between, say, the physical properties of your system and this entanglement classification. I don't make that claim. So I just say that I believe there is some, you know, maybe these inequalities, they constrain your physical system, and also the geometry of the polytope tells you something about entanglement. But how these two things, the physical and the entanglement, if and how are connected, I don't know actually. So I don't know if that answered your question.
Maybe a naive question. So I don't know much about density functional theory, but my impression is that many of the properties of the many-body wave function are captured by the single particle reduced density matrix. I was just curious whether your investigations shed some light on density functional theory.
To be honest, I have to pass. So be happy to talk.
But actually, in the example you showed.
Yeah.
You know, this eigenvalue, three big one, three very small one, so seems very close to the solution determinant.
That's right. That's
a coincidence, or
no? I mean, that's just a matter of what we could do. I mean, we just took this model and we did this sort of perturbatively.
Oh,
you know, you could write down the wave function, the ground state wave function exactly, but then you have to, from there, go to the one particle, you have to integrate out, and then you have to get the eigenvalues.
Okay.
So I think that was the reason why it ended up that we did this in this expansion parameter delta. I mean, we now have another example where it's actually the Hubbard three-site Hubbard model, two-band Hubbard model, and there you can tune the interaction, and it runs on one side all the way to the end of the end of the other side, it sticks to the boundary, and then it moves inside. So if you put
it can be quite far away from this.
It's just sticks to the boundary the whole way along. Yeah.
Okay.
For the Hubbard model, this is it's not published yet, but it's sort of a simpler model also because you straight away you don't have this approximation business, because we straight away started with six levels. We should have started that from the start, but.
Sorry, in this higher dimensional polytopes you showed, how complicated, like how many extreme points did
they, I don't know.
They're
very complicated. So very soon you get thousands of inequalities. So if
then you classify, you explicitly found.
So Alexander Kliachko has a method of computing all these inequalities. So there is an algorithm in principle for which you can do it, but I think the currently highest number people have he has computed this was four, five fermions and 10 modes.
So the results you showed, that was using his.
What I showed you actually was just this Dennis Borland calculation from 72. I mean, we used one more that was later, but But from what I showed you was just this example from 1972 because it's three-dimensional. That's why I can present it sort of nicely. But yes, no, otherwise it's sort of
the thing at the end.
Oh, the thing at the end. Oh, the thing at the end. The thing at the end was about that is about the entanglement polytopes. That's right. I mean, how do you, the entanglement polytopes there, Kliachko's method doesn't work. So Kliachko's method only gives you this outer stuff. For the entanglement polytopes, I mean, that is sort of our result, that it's a convex polytope. And the there, the only way, there is a representation theoretic characterization of it. And the only way of computing this polytope is by using invariant theory to compute the entire representation ring. And that breaks down very quickly. So for So it breaks down very quickly numerically. I mean, exactly. But with algebraic methods, this is one of the highest cases. This is the highest case we could do where we could find in the literature people had computed the generators for this ring. So Levi and Frana computed the generators for this ring, and then you can use this representation theoretic characterization to produce all these polytopes by checking them on these orbits. So that's tricky. That I don't know how far we can go. Not yet as far as for the other, but the other was also not that far yet. So, but we are working on getting a better algorithm for these entanglement polytopes. So, but we have to see.
So the same in the case of the entanglement polytope, you also wouldn't know exactly how many extreme points.
No, I don't know. I don't know. So yeah.
I wonder. So the eigenvalue considered is correspond to some kind of two-state entanglement. It's occupied and unoccupied. There's some kind of a density matrix. It's density matrix on these two possible states, on this orbital. But I wonder whether you can have this two orbital. In the two orbital, you can have four states, you know. No occupation, double occupied, or one occupied, or the other occupied, and then you have this some kind of a more general density matrix on this two orbital.
You talk about the fermions from the
fermions, yes.
Fermions for the start and.
So the way I look at it, this is the following: you look at this eigenvalue of a density matrix,
yes,
occupation number,
yeah,
and can be interpreted as some kind of entanglement density matrix. Where these two states occupy and unoccupied. I just wonder, can you extend that into two orbital? So this is like a single orbital occupation. We don't look at two orbital together.
At two orbits together. Aha. Uh-huh. Because you mean when they have spin, for instance, and you only want to look at the
not just in general two orbital. Because two orbital together you have four possibilities. You know, both orbital are empty, both are occupied, one empty, one occupied. And then there's about, you know, how do you describe? You don't trace out one orbital.
You mean like the particle number is not fixed, or?
Yeah.
When the particle number is not fixed, or?
The particle number is, total particle number is fixed. But however, we examine in more detail. Huh. Here, when you consider the eigenvalue, you only consider the occupation number.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now I'm seeing something more general than occupation number, but something like a density matrix on two orbitals.
So you want to look at like partial density matrices this big. So instead of like taking the eigenvalues, you want to look at like sub-matrices.
Exactly. We have a big density matrix, you have this block of partial density matrix. And then whether one can have similar thing.
Yes, you can.
Each density matrix is no longer a number. Maybe a few parts.
No, I understand.
Partial density matrix and that boundary can be outlined.
No, yes, I think you can. So I think that falls into the framework. So you could first define the map that goes to this partial matrix and then look at, say, the eigenvalues of that one.
Okay.
That works. And then you should be able to also compute the polytope.
Because that may be very useful because, like, it's very two orbital one, right? Because of the interaction, usually, like, two balls in front,
yeah,
our nearest neighbor on the side, you know, those, to compute those interactions, you
yeah.
only need the density matrix on two orbitals.
Yeah, good point. Interesting point, yeah. Yeah, it would be interesting to do that. Yes, I mean, we have not. I mean, one has to be slightly careful with this because as soon as, you know, it's not very easy to find systems where they actually pin because most of the systems you look at, they have some sort of, you know, I don't know, the total spin is conserved or, and if it's conserved in some way, then effectively it cuts down your problem. And often, like for a lot of atoms, it cuts down the problem such that the constraints for the cut down problem are trivial. So, it's not so common, it's not easy to find sort of examples, but yeah, I have the fear sort of that when you do that, you may end up with the constraints being trivial on that subproblem.
But
maybe, yeah.
Actually, it's very easy.
Yeah. Okay, fine. That's good point.
Not just the eigenvalue of the single particle reduced density operators, but in the case of three particles, you look at the two particle reduced density operators as well. And you look in that larger space, is that also a polytope?
I mean, for three particles, the spectrum of the two particle density matrix is the same as of the third one.
Right.
So for this particular case, not, but if you were to, you can do this for more. No, it's not. I mean, the problem is not even governed by its eigenvalues only. But this argument, it's not only governed by the eigenvalue. So there's more, it's actually the two particle reduced density matrix that is relevant. So it's not only governed by the eigenvalues. One still has, I mean, we found one case where we could still give like a representation theoretic characterization of that, which I find kind of nice because it gives you a new proof of strong subadditivity, but we could use that to prove strong subadditivity. But in general, we don't know much about that. It's a, yeah, this is sort of the easiest problem, and it's sort of, the answer is already kind of complicated.